Okay, for the session two, we will talk about some conceptual frameworks to study the very, by far the most advanced regionalism in the world or the European Union. The last session, you already know about the developments or the evolutions of European Union, and I try not to give you only the factual things. I did tell you about some concepts that you may already realize about supranationalism, right? And intergovernmentalism. So this is like a simple concept to determine in which directions in each certain period the EU been going on and on in their integration projects or in their common policies. So I use the word theories and approaches overcoming EU sui generis. In fact, you are Ion scholars, you know that there were big theory, or the big concept that we can call theories, and there were some minor approach that we rather call them approaches. Like our theory, you know about realism, right? Neo-realism, you know better than me. Neoliberalism, yeah. So but there were certain minor approaches that did not capture the whole, like the whole world, but just some part of the EU works. So I think EU by far is the most advanced entity that we could explore in terms of theories and concepts compared to other regionalism like ASEAN, NAFTA, Mercosur, or the UN. Because of the EU itself, it's a very dynamic case. Okay, why sui generis? The word sui generis, meaning that it cannot be copied, right? Like I did tell you last time that we cannot say the EU as a nation state, as international organization entirely, or as international regime, like an environmental regime or health regimes. The EU is sui generis. It's very hard to identify it. It's a kind of architecture that's hard to identify it. So some scholar says that, do you know the UFO? What does the UFO stand for? UFO. ET. Unidentified what? Unidentified flying object. And I like to call the EU as unidentified political object, or UPO. It's like a UFO. And sometimes it's too exhausted to debating what kind of category the EU is, because it's unidentified political object, but it's working. It's working. It did a lot. Some say that it's less than a federation, more than a regime. So some say that it's the first truly postmodern political form. What's the difference between modern and postmodern? You study political theory, or maybe postmodernism in international relations. What is the demarcation of the word modern and postmodern and ancient?
I'm thinking,
okay. Right. Well, in Orthodox way, we say modern, like you say, Westphalian thing, it's a modern nation state, right? So the postmodern among EU scholars is like, it's go over the nation state concept. It's go over the modern nation state or Westphalian concept. So we can call them as a postmodern political form. And Some said it's quasi-federal institutional structures. Federal union or cooperative federalism, because it's not that like a federal state like the German Buddhist Republic of Deutschland. But there is transnational pluralism, high level of civil society engagement, semi-pluralist policymaking. So it is very UPO, very unidentified political object. Which has made EU very special than and difficult maybe compared to ASEAN, as we can say that it is regional organizations in with cooperation base. But we can change the argument when they launch the ASEAN community that they try to be the more integrative projects. Okay? And then when it comes to that, you need to be distinctive between nation states and the EU, and argue again third time, what are the components of nation states? And you remember four. In fact, it can be five or six, but when you say five or six, you think that you failed in trans examination. What are the components of nation states again? Population.
Government.
Sovereignty, territory. Yeah. Okay, start with the most important that, of course, it's very abstractual compared to population, but it's the most valuable of the nation state, the sovereignty. In terms of states, the state going to say that sovereignty is the utmost thing that cannot be divided, cannot be shared. Right? Cannot give up to other. It belongs to the nation states. But in the case of the EU, the case of sovereignty, that we already studied the factual or the evolution in the last class, that in the case of the EU, the sovereignty is sacrificed partially by the member state. So we called it as a pooled sovereignty. Or we could call it as the regional sovereignty. Pooled sovereignty is like a carpool. You know carpool, right? When you were in the same neighborhood and you come together with less vehicles. And then the second thing which lead to the word because of sovereignty is not that important for the EU as much as for a nation state. So they prefer to call themselves other member states in case of instead of sovereign nation states. In ASEAN, we say ASEAN nation states. But the EU are more comfortable to say EU member states instead. You got a different sense in calling the countries in that organization. And then come to the territory. In the part of nation state, you have fixed boundaries. You may argue with me that sometimes the country territory is changed. Like when we argue in Cambodia about Pravihia, you know the place, right? Pravihia Temple. We say that it's changing because of the watershed or whatever. Yeah, it should be changed, but roughly, we know that what are our territories or boundaries, rather fixed. But in the case of the EU, the boundaries kept changing. We call it variable boundaries or non-identifiable region. Why is that? Can you guess? Why the EU could become bigger, bigger, bigger? Yeah, because of the enlargement process. We don't know whether the EU border will end in Turkey. We don't know that in the next future, 10, 20 years, the border will end in Ukraine. So we didn't know that. The boundaries kept changing. So that's very special. Another component. And then you did ask me the last session about the identity. The identity. As you say that, as you see that, when you were, like you were in Thailand, there are some things that you said that you are Thai, right? What you say? And when you say you are Thai, is there anything bad behind that? That combine you as a Thai? Sometimes you don't question it. And you feel it, right? So this certain of coherence in terms of identity, even we got different ethnicities, maybe we got minorities, we got religions different, but there's some certain identity that created that we are Thai. But in the case of the EU, it's like a melting pot. No, it's like a pot, but not really melting. It's a kind of composite identities in which it includes the area that you mix with a lot of regions, subset of religions, ethnicities, ideologies as well. So this is very interesting. And then the governments, the most important guys, right? Nation state, you've got established governments, but in the EU, how to get back? Is Thailand is a nation state? Yes, because we've got a government. So the government doesn't mean that you have to be elected government, right? So you can be military government, feudal government, or election. They come from military process. But the EU didn't have governments, but it can govern without an established governments. And it creates a highly compound governance system, like I told you, there were different levels. There were local level, state level, European level, right? And if you put the concept of democracies, right, in other case, there were fragmented, there were different interpretation of democracies in the EU. Okay? So, this is going to give us harder time when you put in terms of theories. In terms of theories, I did not put on a slide, but I would divide, you can later read my article, but unfortunately it's in Thai. Yeah, about the three generations of EU approaches. And theories. And these kind of generations were developed because they see the actual things happened in Europe. You know the way of we having theory, right? They were inductive and deductive. Sometimes you set the theory and you predict that the world will be like that, right? The world will be so sad. Anarchy. Or the world would be so nice, or love so I, like a liberal. So, but in the case of the EU, the way of making theories is by observing the actual fact, actual happenings that already taken place. So, the first generation of the EU theories, I called it as integration theories. Even they're opposing each other within the group, but they just want to give an answer who are the boss in integration process. So you can guess that this first generation of theory, that will be one side who say that the European Central Authority or supranational authority is a major boss. And that will be the opposing theories who say that? Who? The nation state are the real boss. So we start with the positive one that's saying that the EU is a real boss, which is neo-functionalism. So this concept did follow what the EU did since after the Second World War, or the European Coal and Steel Community that you already studied, right? Why is neo-functionalism the important word is function, right? Call and still. Limited task, but decisive point. So the means or the mechanism is you selecting particular resources, and then you're going to achieve the goals or the ends of establishing the EU or the political union, political community in the end. So this is neo-functionalism. And neo-functionalism tries to argue that you're supposed to have transnational political activities, you're supposed to have the role of the non-state actors rather than the nation states themselves. And the essence of neo-functionalism is that when you select particular function, a limited but decisive point, like coal and steel, it's going to have a certain kind of process called spillover effect. Or how shall I relate the spillover? How do you see in the film, like My Best Friend Wedding or whatever, like you got like a champagne fountain, you lay out the glasses in different layers, right? And then you pour the champagne on the top. And then when the first upper row was filled, it's going to spill over to the second row and the third row. This is a kind of spillover effect. In which, like you see the real case, you see that when they were integrated in coal and steel, and they were very successful, they were ripened, and then they try to think, what should we do next? So they think that, okay, we will spill over to the common market, we will spill over to the Euratom, the atomic energy. So it's a kind of surge and spillover effect, or the functional spillover effect. And then, oh my god, we have a common market, we need four freedoms, but we still have problems because when we want to invest, like British company want to invest in France, well, the currency is different. We need to be charged the transaction cost of France to Germany. Why don't we have a common currency? Why don't we have a single currency? So this is a kind of spillover that the need to complete the previous one, you need to have another projects. So this is kind of a functional spillover. And we thought, you know, in ASEAN, there's some argument that can we find any function between us? And people say that shall we have like a ASEAN rice community or ASEAN rubber community? But the thing is, we are so competing among ourselves in the same product. So this did not really happen. And then, another spillover, another kind of spillover, we call it as a political spillover. Political spillover is how the pressure, all the pressure groups, you know, like you are Thai, you know about the rubber case, right? I hope you're not be caught in jail. You know that the price was so cheap, right? And the rubber farmers, they come to ask for the higher price, right? So, who are they bargaining? Who are they lobbying? They're lobbying the government. They're lobbying the authority. But the political spillover of the EU means that the lobbying process is not just go to the state level. They go to the supranational level, you know. The case that I like to tell the student is the German case. Like in Germany, you know, there is a federal state. They got a federal government, a central government, and then they got nearly 20 in each area. Like in Munich, it's under Bavaria state. So they've got their own tax policy, their own education policy. So sometimes it's quite hard when you want to transfer credit if you were from different federals apart. So the thing is, in Brussels, where there were so many lobbying going on, apart from you have German government representatives, you got a Bavarian. They call it like Bavarian embassy, but it's not exactly embassy per se, but they got their own office to monitor the interest or the disadvantages of anything that's going on in Brazil for particular. So you see how this lobbying, the oppression thing is not really limited to nation state or German state alone. Even the French farmers or the farmers association, they shift the lobbying or the pressure groups to the Brussels level. So it's very compounding system. And the last thing on the old functionalism, they observed that this process was done by elite, like first the French elite, who wanted to control Germany after the war. So you need a pro-integrationist elite or elite socialization, like Jean Monnet, Konrad Adenauer, not Charles de Gaulle, okay? Not General Charles de Gaulle. So the EU is the boss for the first generation, the first group. And the second one, going to argue that, no, not the EU. The real boss is still nation state. So this argument is really coming from the realist idea, right? That the nation state are the most powerful actors in international relations. So they criticize the previous one. They say that the new old functionalism are not really working, right? And this intergovernmentalism, we call it IG, in which is not Instagram. It was IG before Instagram was invented, right? The IG, well, within the IG concept, there are also different sub-IG. There were one who influenced by neorealism. Do you know what neorealism is? You know better than me. I'm European studies trained, not I, Alfred. What's different between realism and neorealism? Well, start with realism is easier. You mean neo-realism?
Yes.
Yeah, more on the structure.
On the
state behavior. The control state behavior. And how about realism?
Realism is like more focused on the human nature.
Human nature and state not really cannot working together at all, something like that?
Realism focuses mainly on the survival of the state.
Yeah? Survival of the state. By expanding military power?
For the concept, mainly in the military affairs.
Right,
affairs.
Very hard. Uh-huh.
So according to the realist perspective, there is no global governance.
Uh-huh. There were anarchy, there were global governance, it's a self-help, self-survival. But when you put, you know something interesting, that when you put the word neo in front, it's completely different from the ancient one, right? And when it's come to neorealism, they thought that, well, states surrender, not really surrender to the EU, but they thought that is the thing that EU give or the policy that EU deliver is not contradict nation state interest. And sometimes they want the EU to control the other behavior, other state behavior as well, right? So this is part of neoliberalism. And when the member state feel that this is not going to work for us, I won't join. So the theorists in this part try to use like a Eurocast, like why Britain, Denmark, Sweden not joining the Euro, because they thought it's not going to benefit the economy. So this is neoliberalism. But neoliberalism, this is neoliberalism in terms of international relations, not neoliberalism in terms of economy. It's like neoliberal institutionalism. It's more positive. They thought that, okay, this is the benefit of the EU, right? So, but still, state is still the most powerful actors. And they think the integration serves national interests rather than community interest. But sometimes, according to neoliberalism, it can go in the same way. So when seeing the case, you know, the first group of IG, they talk about the case that we did last time, General Charles de Gaulle declined to send representative of France to the meeting, and that's called empty chair crisis, not music chair crisis. So, you know, is disrupt the whole commission, sorry, the whole council meetings, because the agreement not going anywhere in our front. And then the important scholar is Hoffman's in the European Sisyphus Essays on Europe 1964 to 1994. So that's what I tell you, that the way that we retrieve the theories and approach about EU is by observing what actually going on in the EU. And then the scholar brought a theory after that. And then another guy, Andrew Marchek, preference and power in the European community, a liberal IG approach, a liberal intergovernmentalism and integration rejoinder. So you see Hoffman, who inspired by neoliberalism, in which, okay, when Charles de Gaulle feel that he's not going to serve France, I'm quitting. By the way, Marchek, the second one, his idea of the liberal IG try to integrate the concept of liberal democracy or the representative democracy or the electorate democracy. He feel that, you know, like in a, it's a little bit to live against, like, take it like this. Why I use our example of Thai governments, which is quite risky. In the case of public health, you know that in WTO there is like a TRIPS agreement. Do you know TRIPS? What is TRIPS? Trade related in intellectual property, right? So most of the TRIPS negotiation is about the patent of pharmaceutical drugs. And what's the problem of Thailand is that we got the large public health problems, right? And we want to have like a cheap medicine or CL or the drug over the patent, because the drug with patent is very expensive. So this is the need of the people. But the Thai government, in the same time, I mean all governments, not only this government, they go to the World Trade Organization and the negotiation. And then they were forced by pharmaceutical company, the large pharmaceutical company, like European pharmaceutical companies. And then they say that, the drug company say that, I need to maintain the patent. Because it took us for research, for laboratory, we invest a lot to create a new drugs. If you're not paying it, we got no incentive to invent for R&D. So there were no new development of drugs. So the Thai government could come back to the country and say to the people that, well, we just have to pay the full price medicine because we need to respect the WTO rules to respect intellectual property rights. So this is a kind of two-level game that you use the international regimes to be an excuse to tell your people that I didn't want to do this, you know. But because they forced me to do so, you know what I mean? So this is representing the liberal democracy world of this IT thing, which not necessarily only the case of the EU. So this is the first generation to see that whether it is a state or whether it is the European Union themselves. So why don't we try to put it on ASEAN? Neo-functionalism is not going to use, will be useless, completely useless in the case of ASEAN. And the IG is working, only the IG is working, because they're the most powerful actors, right? Can you give me an example? Like the case that the ASEAN member said, not really listen to ASEAN. ASEAN base breaking, something like that. Is there any cases?
Thinking of the case of the forest fire in Indonesia.
In what?
Forest fire.
Forest fire.
In Indonesia. Well, this issue has been a problem for ASEAN for like many years, but like for decades, but you know, the ASEAN still doesn't have, you know, the way to solve it, even though they have the ASEAN has agreement in, I'm not sure the year, 2000 something. Was launched, but you know, still they are debating about, you know, whether who should be responsible for that. For example, the Indonesian, you know, authorities may say that the business people from Singapore and Malaysia who invested a lot in Indonesia in how to say planting those palm trees, you know. Need to be responsible palm oil, you know, needs to be responsible for that because they own the land. But the Malaysia authorities may say Indonesia has to, you know, take responsibility because it's within Indonesian sovereignty, and the ASEAN just, you know, do nothing, you know, just like it's like Although it's, you know, affecting like more than 3 or 4 countries, you know. Yeah.
Interesting case. You know, there's a word called environmental injustice. The thing is like a forest fire. It's like the broader Kyoto Protocol, we discussed about it, because the country that did release a lot of CO2, like for example China or Brazil, and it's create global warming, right? And it's going to create the acid rain. But the acid rain not falling onto them, but falling into Africa, you know? So it's a kind of certain, the thing that they did not produce. So it's unfair or injustice. Is there any other case? Maybe not necessarily to be ASEAN. Or the other international organization that members don't really get along with her regimes. Okay, so we move to the second generation, and we have break 5 minutes to share the tip. In my last session, have you seen the outline? You got assignment of the debate. Have you seen that? EU and ASEAN, so I need to tell you first because we won't meet each other until April. So you're going to divide 6 and 6. You got 12, right? Or 11?
No, less than that.
So you try to buy a divine ascent group and EU group, and normally I've got the motion in Thai called EU ที่เก่าแก่หรือจะแน่กว่าอาเซียน now I try to translate it. Right, the idea is the debate is that you on one side is supporting the EU in every aspect, defend everything about the EU, even the EU gone bankrupt, even the Eurozone, even the EU failed to accept refugee, whatever. And then the other side, going to talk about ASEAN. And, okay, we talk about the debate for the final class. And, you know, ASEAN is increasingly important because last 2 months when I was in Europe and there were a refugee crisis, I was caught up in September. You know, the BBC, they broadcast the AEC launch. And they said that the AEC is the most promising, the West way. The AEC is the most promising, and it won't repeat the mistakes of the Eurozone, or whatever. So you try, the ASEAN part have to say that, well, we are established from different settings, different ideology, and then we cooperate. We got ASEAN way, which is very impressive. We don't fight one another. We are too polite to tell the others that you are a violation of human rights. You should call for election. Okay, we all go to the prison. So that's the idea. So you need to draw first who's going to be the EU and who are going to be the ASEAN, and you go head to head for like a speech, like for 10 minutes.
For one person.
But you should left room to counterattack the one that launched the issue before you. So it's like you prepare mainly, but don't draw the speech. It's not like you come to talk the speech. You draw the issues and then you prepare to rebut your opponent back. So you can use in terms of more factual origin history, and you also can use in terms of the article to clash one another. Mm-hmm. So we come to the second generation, and to repeat again, the first generation of EU study, they're arguing who are the boss of integration, the EU or the state, and they try to show the case, right? But for the second generation, I called it the alternative theories for policy studies. And as I say, the way we derive theories or approach to study the EU regionalism is by far the very, very, very exotic, because we observe the fact first. And then, when the EU developing, ECSC, EEC, Euratom, and it turns out that the common policy that the EU delivered was very successful. Therefore, the focus of the second generation, the theories, they're not focused on actors, or the EU, or the state anymore, but they focus on that. Have you studied political science or public administration, right? Have you heard about David Easton system theory that you had to study when you were first year? Those black box. Can you tell me, in the rough way, how it operates?
Like a
microphone.
I think it operates like a machine.
Uh-huh.
Like where they have an input, and then they have something.
The demand. Uh-huh.
And then they have the output, and after that is feedback.
Outcome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So, I know that you are an IR student, international relations student, but I think you did some introduction to political science, right? So, now the second generation, they're more focused on the policy-making process rather than the actors, the boss themselves. So, this second generation was influenced a lot by the public administration field and the political science field and comparative politics field. Rather than the IR, the grand theory, we always call IR the grand theory. And we feel grand or not, I don't know. Now, there were more on approaches on policy studies, policy science, okay? Starting with the first one. The first one is the new institutionalism, right? Again, when you use the word new or new in front, something must be changed, right? Like realism was totally different from neorealism. And then new institutionalism, they try to say that try to be spiritual. Institution didn't have heart, right? Okay, the traditional institutionalism one are like here, Faculty of Political Science, Thomas Hart University. If it were just an institution, so it's just like a cement building, right? Lifeless, soulless. But in new institutionalism, the argument is that the institutions matter. Institution act, right? So the institution act rather than asking secretariat in the past that, oh, it's just a building in Jakarta. But now ASEAN secretariat start to act a lot after the ASEAN community launched. So, institution matters in new institutionalism. And within the new institutionalism, they try to explain how they act in different ways, right? How they act in different ways. The first one, the rational choice institutionalism, right? Rational choice, in fact, involve a lot with the political science and economics field, right? Why rational choice? You study intro to economics, right? What economics are for? Economic subject. Why you need to be rational?
Well, because that is the limited resources.
Yeah, because it's scarce.
Yes, so you have to utilize it well.
Correct. So, in terms of the EU, all the actors will be very considerate, and in rational choice, they try to explain that, you know, in the nation states alone, if you are a businessman, you need to calculate, right? Oh, I want that project, right? Or how can I get a project? How can I get the government public procurement to build the road? Shall I go to that guy, this guy, right? But in the case of the EU, it's more complex than that. Because not only you have to go to the European level, you have to consider not about corruption abroad, but you need to consider how to lobby in a different kind of voting, right? So, like just in the case, like a coffee shop, like if like the you are Starbucks, is a from where?
The US.
Yes, right. And then you go to the local European countries, and then you feel like a there were some certain European countries that, okay, Starbucks could open, but not at the main road or at the corner. No, no, I just made it up. But it's happened in Russia. Starbucks will be very hide away, you know? It's not that under, how to say, the very center area to preserve the national Russian coffee house brand. So you have to calculate, shall I go to, if the issue was to be voted, and if I'm the monopoly myself, whether I was monopolized or whether I'm the one who monopoly, right? Whether it was qualified majority voting, and I need to calculate a lot, which members that really took on my side or still hesitant to make them support me. So this is a rational choice, our institutionalism, because a competition policy is the very first common policy of the European Union. And after reform treaties like Nice, Amsterdam, Lisbon gave a lot of power to the European Parliament, now the Parliament become another center of focus for the lobby. You have to go to Parliament as well, go to the Member European Parliament, or go to the President of the largest parliamentary groups in the EU. So it's become highly calculated in terms of rational choice institutionalism. And then, this comes to the word institution matters, right? So Pollack said the word principal agent. Principal is like nation state, and the agent is European Commission. It's like, you know, it's like I am James Bond, 007, MI6. You know MI6?
Yeah.
They already have MI6, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. Near the river. The thing is, have you watched the latest James Bond? What is the name of the...
Spectre.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh my god. When is that? Which year?
Last year.
Oh my god! It's not that one.
You meant the Skyfall?
Is that one that... Which one that James Bond did not listen to his boss? Is the last one or that the one before?
The one before.
Or even the one before. Quantum of Solace, he
didn't listen to it.
The one that he said, the one that he refused, okay, just keep. Any episode is okay. Okay, take him as a 007, right? Or I am European Commission. I was assigned by the MI6 or my principal to do the secret mission. And then one day, what's her name? M or Q?
M.
M said that. Abort, mission abort, bones, don't fire him, abort. And then I'm James Bond. No, M. I will follow him. I'm not aboard. You know? Do you know what the picture is? You're laughing. No. So, the commission is like, the institution become alive and become matters. And then it becomes stronger. Stronger than the members that did get the power to them at the origin. And it's become like this. So, it's very important that institutions become increasing important roles, like 007. It's a very bad metaphor, but I like it. And it's come to any other explanation, the historical institutionalism. They try to say that institution matters, and then they make a historical move in the past, and then they were successful with that. If you want to contradict, what they did in the past, it's impossible, right? For example, they call this as path dependency. It's like, have you studied law philosophy, right? When you have a case that you have to judge, and there were no example of the case or the law that said about this case before, and then it's entitled to the judge, to the head judge, to say, okay, I will say this guy is wrong because this is that, and it's become adopted as the next law in the future. How to say กฎหมาย จารีต อะไรเงี้ย ภาษาอังกฤษ
customs
like customary practice. So this is a kind of path dependency. For example, take a foreign direct investment. Nowadays, industrial factory, you know that they pollute a lot. They pollute the water, they pollute the air by the carbon dioxide, CO2. But environmental law in the EU is very strict, right? If you pollute, you have to pay, right? They got the tax, they got the carbon tax in many industries, also aviation industries. This creates the high cost for them, for production, because they have to use environmental friendly. They have to take care, they have to get rid of the byproducts that they made. So, the foreigners, maybe they want to set up their factory. They don't want to come to the EU because they feel that it's going to charge me a lot for the cost. So maybe I go to China because they get more relaxed in terms of environmental law. Maybe I go to invest in China and they've got a quite okay laborers, skilled laborers. So I will produce commodities cheaper, right? So if the situation is like this, one day, for example, one member state say that, can we just don't relax this environmental law? Because otherwise, the foreign investment will go to somewhere else. You know, it's not going to happen. Because this become path dependency. It's become the norm, become the rules that it's like 007, and I told you that. It's going to be changed. And institutions are very important, okay? For the last one, sociological institutionalism is related a lot for the third gen, so I will be talk at the third gen. And then the second group, the policy network. The policy network also is an approach because it just look at the first stage of the policy making, which is the policy initiator at hand. Policy network is a kind of certain organization that have a common like interest, such as farmer association, business association, or scientist association, which are very strong, very, very highly strong in Europe, and they are very vetted in terms of lobbying. So we got two types. We got the policy communities in which they are very strong. And we got the issue networks. Issue networks means that when you feel that your interests are affected, a la carte, like food, like not a kind of epistemic community like our scientist association. It's like a certain issues like the pension will be cut, the welfare will be cut, something like that, the MET, right? So this is issue networks. So these policy networks are important because they are in one direction. They want the organization, institution of the EU to work for them, to meet their interest. And on the other way around, the EU institutions also need them because the EU staff is not plenty enough to get hold of all information. They were the one who hold information like our dairy products, cereal farmers, they know everything about that. So they were two way of policy shaping and knowledge are sharing. So this is policy network try to explain. And then the next one, MLG, multi-level governance. Yeah, we did talk a lot that the policy making is not only local municipalities, state level, it comes supranational or European level. So there were three or maybe more. Because you got also, like you say, Scotland, Northern Ireland, Catalonia. Which one want to do? You want to do Catalonia? Separation from Spain. So, this multi-level governance made the state retreat, right? The government of nations said not exactly the boss, because in the EU management, you know, the EU could give the money directly to the regions, which is smaller than the nation states. So, the multi-level governance come from a very good comparative politics one. And then supranational governance is also like path dependency, like I told you, like environmental regime, hygiene standard. Like we used to have we argued at food export. And I take the example of supranational governance. The EU is very, I think the EU got a higher standard in terms of food safety. And there was a policy called zero tolerance on residues, right? Like, for example, if they detect the veterinary drug or animal drugs, like hormone or whatever, very, very, very tiny part, like a part per billion, the product will be destroyed immediately, like a chicken meat or whatever. So this becomes a kind of governance or regime that cannot be relaxed. This kind of standard cannot be relaxed, cannot be changed, okay? And the last one is regulatory state. Well, they perform three functions according to political science. They are distribution. But in the case of the EU is small in terms of stuff. So the way that the EU can do is regulate to make sure that the money was properly utilize, deliver, and make sure that it meet the standards. So this is the second generation that you will see that. It observes there were similarity, even explain a different thing. The similarity is that even they cannot categorize the EU to be any type, but they think the EU is the political system, like a system of David Easton. It's a functioning political system. That's why I said it's governance without governments. So this is the important second generation that focuses on policy making. Yes? Okay, can you press on the mic?
Okay, I think about the issue that my concern about the theory a little bit about transnational crime and terrorism. Is that in the case of the EU, they do hard work in order to prevent the a further attack from the terrorism?
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing that, according to the last case in Indonesia, that
mm-hmm.
have some cause from the terrorist attack. So what do you think that, what would be a accommodation for the change in this kind of thing that, you know, it develops into more and more complexity for the transnational crimes and terrorism for this EU and ASEAN?
Right, right. Difficult question, difficult to handle as well, because well, this kind of even the tourism was supposed to be regulated by the cooperation of justice and criminal matters, right? But and also it's linked a lot with the common foreign and security policy. And I think the EU did share information a lot. And I'm not sure about the French, are they about to pass a law? It's called surveillance law that you can tap, right? I'm not sure whether it's passed through or not. But I think in the case of ASEAN, I think they start to have a cooperation more, integrate more, like in the case of ASEAN police. There used to be established cooperation for a long time, but so it's become more complex because you have to cooperate in ASEAN and you need to share information with Europe and the US as well about the IS, because when they come as a, in Europe, when they may mix with the influx, right? But in here, they come as a tourist, right? And it's based on the intelligence sharing, not only within our region, we have to like exchanging like interregional two regions together exchanges. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Yeah. As you mentioned before, like ASEAN doesn't care much about the domestic affair, but I want to ask, like, is there any opportunity, like, in the future that ASEAN domestic politics will become increasingly subject to ASEAN policy making, like the EU?
Right. Like we just discussed, that we have to go back to the first question, whether ASEAN want to be like the EU in the end, right? Because if ASEAN didn't want to be like the EU in the end, it's going to be hard to answer the questions, because this Europeanization thing is by far the most advanced level, right? Because it's like the whole administration and the whole norms of the EU was embedded in the nation states level. And if ASEAN want to be like that, it should take many decades, because you need to be our supranational like the EU, and you have to be working together for a long time. Even though we're working all together for a long time, but there were still challenges and crisis happened. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes. Regarding the issues of refugees, I just recently heard the news that Denmark is passing the law that, you know, try to expel the refugees out to their origins.
Mm.
And do you think that will the EU have the possible solutions for, you know, refugees, you know, rather than, you know, putting your money, you know, just like throw the money to setting the camps and something like that, or how to say, because the reasons that those refugees, you know, cross the border to EU to Europe is that they are struggling with the armed conflicts, And root cause of the armed conflict is poverty, something like that. Poverty is like one part of that. So will the EU do something in Africa or those MENA countries, you know, to like solve the poverty so that the problems of refugees will not, you know, threaten Europe in the future?
So many issues in it. So there were Denmark case, there were our EU refugee issues, but I think let's go back to the more fundamental thing. It's the identity crisis, I think. Because, like I say, that the EU, they try to assert the European identity, right? But they were very multicultural, and the identity was very composite rather than coherent. And you cannot deny that the rich member states did need the migrants for work in the past, because there were certain jobs that they can't do by themselves, like construction or the labor-intensive job, that they need the refugees. And then when it's connected with the religion extremist, and that's a problem, well, it's quite sad to hear that the country up north, the Nordic countries, the sense of our Islamophobia very intensely high, especially when you take about the non-EU case in Norway, in which it's a place where you awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, but the sense of the population against the migrant and the right-wing movements become very strong, which is very, very threatening the fundamental EU integration, because EU integration is supposed to tolerate, right? And you have the 9/11, and you have the 13/11, and you have Charlie Hebdo, and Paris got two attacks in the same year. And the EU will have to be worried. Everything, you know, gathering up, like when the right-wing extremist party be elected to be the member of the European Parliament. So these are right tendencies very, 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 very strong. And we have to, I think the EU need to sort it out, because in the refugee crisis, they were in dilemma, because the member state certain refused to take the refugees, right? Like I told you that they were voting in wet. I mean, they got vetted votes. So the number of the refugees that each country will take on quota, we also dissimilar, like they distribute the vote, in which some country in Central Europe didn't want to adopt them. So it's to be the big, 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 big problems. And we could learn from that. We have issues of Rohingya, right? But yeah, we could learn from that, because even the Rohingya, we cannot sort it out, right? When comparing the size and the amount of the people that flee from, people may argue that they flee from armed conflict, or people may argue that they flee because they want a better life. Right? There were many debates about our Rohingya, but even that, you cannot sort it out. I mean, in the ASEAN level, who going to take these people, right? But the issue of Europe is by far bigger in terms of amount and size. Yeah, so we have to see and learn as well. Mm-hmm. And complex. They come from Asia, they come from MENA. Yeah, and not only Rohingya cases. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Do you think that China could be a threat for EU? or if that's so, can you have the strategies or policy that to counterbalance with the rise of China in terms of a various perspective?
Interesting. I think major powers like the U.S., well, to some extent, the EU always worried about China roles, right? Whether China rise will be peaceful rise or aggressive rise. I think the EU will worry more in terms of economic competition with China rather than political security one compared to the US. Because as I say that, let me just talk about the case for direct investment, right? China is attractive. They don't have to be democracy, but people want to go and invest there because it's flexible. The environmental law was not that fierce, like in the case of the EU, like we talk about in terms of theoretical approach, not very strict. So, yeah, I think that you're worried about economic terms rather than political security one. Yeah. Okay, we finish a little bit early, Friday night. Evacuate the building. Okay, thank you, and I hope you produce a very great debate. Okay. Well, like I say that in April, we will have a debate, ASEAN-EU debate, in which you'll be divided to be two teams. One is ASEAN team, and one is the EU team. Who are in ASEAN? Okay, so the remaining is in EU team. So, well, we got expert here from ASEAN. They could maybe help you what kind of debates, because apart from whatever shall we do, the thing is, in the past debate was quite not interesting because ASEAN was by far behind the EU, but you know that now the EU faced so many challenges, or maybe we call trouble, in terms of the Eurozone economic downturn, the sovereign debt crisis, and maybe you can relate how the ASEAN economy, I mean, in which oil topic that the ASEAN team could use to culture back.
My goodness. Well, my pressure as well, but pressure to be here as well. But the thing is, it's really tough questions as well. What's an issue that ASEANs can gain? I mean,
maybe you don't have to compare, but there's like an ASEAN style economic running that could be advantages, points for debate.
I think that for us, being an ASEAN is quite unique. It's quite unique in the sense that we not really care about the development to be a supra, to have a supranational organization, a supranational unit, just like an EU. But not being a supranational unit, just like an EU, for us as an ASEAN who interested in the development of institutional developments of ASEAN, perceive that it's uniqueness and it's become a strength, because these sort of thing can hold us together, because it's really loose relationship. Means that I don't really want to care about your domestic affair regarding the non-interference, non-interventionist. But many people think that that's the weak point, because you just can't move forward, I mean, so fast. But at the end of the day, we realize that that particular point become a strength.
To
issues of ASEAN. So that's why Laos, Cambodia, Myanmar are so happy to join us.
Mm-hmm.
And even we move, not so fast, but it's hardly to deny that we move gradually at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tired.
And you're not break.
Yeah, it's not break. And nobody don't really want to get out from ASEAN.
Uh-huh.
No threatening situations among the ASEAN member country. So some perceive that as the weakness in terms of non-interference principle. But at the end of the day, many scholars realize that, my gosh, it's strength.
Mm-hmm.
Issues that pull us together
mm-hmm.
at the end of the day. And then we move slowly,
mm-hmm.
gradually, but firmly
mm-hmm.
somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point because Professor Sunita did not talk only about the like a custom-made ASEAN style of economic integration. She also talked about the theoretical approach that we just did. Because if we did talk about this 5 years ago, if we did debating ASEAN due to Laos, right? We don't have single currency. We don't have the monetary or macroeconomic policy harmonization. But now you see how what happened in Greece and the rich countries say that they want to
kick them all.
No, they want to either you go or we go
yes.
go back to Deutschmark.
Mm.
So now it's quite equal par, right, for the debate. And I don't feel that the ASEAN team is less advantageous compared to
the EU
team. How about the ASEAN way about the political conflicts compared to the refugees? I give you a hard time.
Yeah, so much. Sorry,
you think okay, I introduce her first. Okay, our special guest, Dr. Sunita Arunpiphat from Brady Phnom Penh College. She got BA first class honors for the administration. I remember everything. And she got MBA from Cambridge, LSE, and Master of International Economy and Finance at Chulalongkorn University. It's a very tough course. She got a PhD from Peter Subhashek and wrote a lot about ASEAN. Yeah. Right. So in terms of supranational and hangover sovereignty, you think that ASEAN is supposed to be that way? Don't try to be like the EU. Because in terms of setting the ASEAN community, they have to surrender, right? If they want to do that.
But nobody would like to surrender.
Yeah.
And nobody would like to. I think that at the end of the day, for me, I don't really think that ASEAN, at the end of the day, can continue the development patterns to perfectly, duplicate what the EU have done so far. I think that at the end of the day, at the final end, these two regional organizations will end up with the different patterns in terms of institutional design. Because we do realize that the background, the characteristic of these two regions, so much difference. In EU, they share a lot in terms of the commonality, right? Religious, for example, right? The kingdom, Christianity, right? The kingdom that rules mainland Europe, or even including the England. But when you look back to ASEAN, come on, religious, we have Buddhism, we have Christian, we have Islamic, right? So diverse. So it means that the background or the characteristic or the foundations of ASEAN and EU is so much different. And because we're so much different, how come that one sort of institutional design can fit all. For me, I don't really think that these two regional organizations, these two regions, can end up with the same institutional design.
How about the structures of production? Like, they're producing the same thing? Is it still the argument of ASEAN? or not anymore? More diverse?
It's more diverse for me. I think that it's more diverse. But the thing is, we still don't really know because there is no theoretical or conceptual framework right now in order to explain what truly happens from ASEAN, because we need to admit that the theoretical frameworks or conceptual framework currently we adopt from outside. It's not yet established from within. So that's why we still stick together with neo-functionalism and intergovernmentalism. So that's why these two key main theoretical frameworks still, I mean, influence and dominate our thinking about
intergovernmentalism.
And then that's it. We don't really have any alternatives in order to explain what truly happens in ASEAN. And even in terms of economic integrations, we still stick with blah blah blah. My goodness, and then is it explained right? And it's explained now that okay, if you like to, how can I say, move forward in terms of economic integrations, you need to follow 5 steps: free trade, pass-on, come on, and then end up with political unions. But in ASEAN, how come which step that we are in, right? Because if we think in ourselves, we skip level 2, right? Because level 2, you need to have a common external tariff with ASEAN done in this life. Not within 50 years, for sure. That we're going to share, right? We're going to end up with... No! Sorry.
Oh, God.
I can't. So loud. Sorry for that. I didn't do that. Sorry.
Powerhouse.
It's not that. No! And we don't even plan it. We don't even plan it about external. The
yeah, that's a good
external,
point for ASEAN.
Right?
Yeah.
So it simply means that in case of ASEAN, we skip from step 1 to step 3. Yes, we have free flows of goods, free flows of services, free flows of capital, you know, free levels of capital, free flows of skilled labor, and not include non-skilled labor. Oh, it's so exclusive for someone with high occasions, right? So, we skip from step 1, we skip step 2, and then go to step 3. And how come the blah 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 economic integration 5-step can, sorry, truly explain ASEAN?
We want you to be in the drama club.
Yes, it's me. See, so that's why, I mean, for me, we truly dominated by somebody else. The theoretical framework, so it simply means that theoretical frameworks or conceptual framework from within not yet established.
Yeah.
Not yet developed, no matter what, from ASEAN scholars or from outsider. So that's why.
Yeah.
So that's why. For me, it's true.
Okay.